This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Today, we reflect on the life and legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Racial equality was an unmet moral imperative in King's day. Today, a quick glance at the Oval Office shows just how far we've come. But a quick glance at Ferguson, Missouri, shows just how far we still have to go. While racial justice remains a moral issue, of course, a growing body of evidence highlights the tangible benefits of embracing diversity, racial, ethnic, or simply, as economist Dr. Richard Freeman calls it, the diversity of ideas. You'll hear from Richard Freeman later this hour. First, while much of the nation has been focused on protests sparked by the high-profile deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner at the hands of police, my first guest today has kept his attention squarely trained on a more insidious threat. While the impacts often go untallied, the numbers are clear. Men, women, and children of color are far more likely to be impacted by environmental pollution. Dr. Daniel Faber is professor of sociology at Northeastern University and director of the Northeastern Environmental Justice Research Collaborative. Reports he co-authored in 2001 and 2005 have shaped environmental justice policy in Massachusetts. He joins me now from a studio at WGBH in Boston. Daniel Faber, welcome to Living Lab. Is there one particular injustice that set you on your current course?
Well, I've been working around the country and even internationally looking at disparities that communities face with respect to the ecological crisis. And my travels around the United States, I always heard, well, New England's a blue state. Class and racial-based disparities can't be that bad with respect to the environmental crisis. So that led me to launch this study. And what we found in Massachusetts is that we have some of the most profound racial and class disparities with respect to the unequal exposure to ecological hazards that you will find anywhere in the United States.
How do you go about quantifying that? I mean, how do you rank the environmental threats and link that up with potential civil rights issues?
Well, Massachusetts is a little unusual, and we have a very good system of record keeping with regard to various types of ecologically hazardous sites and facilities. So the study we did here really analyzed all of these different types of hazards, like power plants, toxic waste sites, including industrial facilities, and put them together, and we have like a cumulative measure. And what we find is the cumulative environmental burden in communities of color is over 20 times greater than what you find in white communities. So, for example, in communities of color, there's an average of 48 hazardous waste sites per square mile in comparison to predominantly white communities where there's an average of just 2 hazardous waste sites per square mile. So that's an enormous disparity. Furthermore, if you look at, for example, in chemical pollution, toxic pollution coming from large industrial facilities, we found over a 10-year span that there was an average of almost 200,000 pounds of chemical pollution released into the air and water and land in communities of color compared to about 19,000 pounds in predominantly white communities. So again, these tremendous disparities. And if you look at the type of pollution, even though communities of color only make up less than 10% of all the towns in Massachusetts, they receive well over 41% of all the worst toxic chemicals, about 40% of all the carcinogens, and nearly 40% of all the reproductive toxins. So the worst types of pollution is heavily concentrated in communities of color.
If you Google environmental justice Massachusetts, and any of our listeners can do this, the first thing that comes up, the first hit, is an environmental justice viewer created by the state of Massachusetts, which is a map of the state with these different environmental justice communities highlighted. Now, some of those are highlighted because of the kinds of race issues that you were just talking about, but there are other factors, right? There's race, there's language, there's socioeconomic factors. So is there a formal definition for an environmental justice community?
Well, the way I think about this is in terms of political power. How much power does a community have to resist the siting of ecologically hazardous sites and facilities in that community? And those communities that are where people have less time and energy to mobilize themselves, where the community is highly fragmented, where people are poor, then they have less resources. And this is true nationwide. There was a state of California a number of years ago had great difficulty in accepting, getting communities to accept the siting of incinerators in their communities. And for good reason. If you live near an incinerator, they typically emit a lot of heavy metals, dioxins, mercuries. They're very dangerous. And residents were resistant to having incinerators sited in their community. So the state contracted out with Sorrell Associates to help them figure out where to site these facilities. And on page 51 of the report, they conclude, under no circumstances should such a facility be built within 5 miles of a white middle-class community because of the greater likelihood of encountering political opposition. Instead, they suggested the targeting of Catholic communities, which they considered more conservative, poor communities, communities that are rural and where the offending facility would be on one line of political jurisdiction and the affected population on the other. In other words, solely in terms of a community's ability to resist, rather than what are the safest, most optimum climatic or geographic or geologic conditions. So,
is that kind of targeting legal?
In state of California, was if you look in Los Angeles, for example, they built all 17 incinerators they built in Los Angeles were located in low income communities of color. 91% of the people living in the impact zone around the incinerators were people of color. Now, since the Sandoval decision in the Supreme Court, it's made it very, very difficult to win many of these challenges because under Sandoval, you have to prove the intent to discriminate. In other words, you need a document from a corporation saying, we are siting this facility in this community because of their race. And it is almost impossible to prove that. Now, we do have on occasion such documents, but I've been testifying in cases all around the state where I can go in, for example, in Brockton, where they're building a power plant near a elementary school. Brockton has one of the highest proportion of environmentally hazardous sites and facilities of any city in the state, and it's a low-income community of color. And I can demonstrate the one facility after another, hazardous toxic waste site is being located there after another, but the law does not allow for considerations of a cumulative environmental impact. You have to take it case by case and prove that there's an intent to discriminate. So right now the civil rights law framework really is not working to protect these communities. If I go back and talk about, for example, so falling Los Angeles, I just want to make this point. So what you saw in Los Angeles around incinerators also happened here in Massachusetts. The state built 4 incinerators in the 1970s in a 12-square-mile area of Lawrence. Lawrence is one of the poorest communities of color in the entire state. And over the years, each one of these incinerators emitted thousands of pounds of mercury alone as well as other types of heavy metals. And the Biodiversity Institute just released a report, and they found the highest levels of mercury in the entire eastern United States are now located in the Merrimack Valley. And mercury is a very, very potent neurotoxin. It really destroys the brain. So in many ways, these environmental justice communities are becoming sacrifice zones. They are – more and more of these industries are being concentrated in low-income communities of color. And they are becoming the sacrificial lambs, and the law is totally inadequate to address it.
When you first brought this problem to the attention of the public and to politicians in Massachusetts in 2001 with your first environmental justice report about Massachusetts, Governor Sulucci responded by putting into place an environmental justice policy. Is that addressing any of these deficiencies that you're talking about? Is the situation getting any better?
Well, it was an important first step, and it was the first time really the state recognized that it had a problem. And there were some improvements, but over time we've seen that the situation has actually grown worse. And this is true nationally as well as within Massachusetts, in the sense that as more and more corporations are required to, for example, collect toxic waste. They're looking for ways to dispose of it. So they may contract out with chemical waste management to dispose of it in the cheapest way possible, but also the manner which is most politically feasible. So as more and more pollution is becoming commodified, if you will, and becoming increasingly geographically mobile, it is being increasingly relocated into communities that lack the political economic power to resist. So if ocean dumping of sewage sludge is banned and cities like New York City can't do that, well, on the face of it, that's a good thing. But if they're loading up 3,000 railroad cars every week and transporting the sewage sludge, which is laden with toxic metals, and deposit it in communities like Sierra Blanca, Texas, which is 80% Hispanic, 50% of the population lives below the poverty line, and they spread out the sewage sludge over a 200-square-mile area, and George Bush created 200 such sites in Texas for receiving sewage sludge from the East Coast when he was governor, then the ecological crisis, if you will, is being increasingly displaced from one realm of nature to another, from one group of people to another, and typically those are working-class white communities and communities of color. So we found the same thing in Massachusetts. So for 5 years, we were pressuring Governor Deval Patrick to do something about it. And one of his last acts of governor, I'm proud to say, right before Thanksgiving break, was to adopt an executive order on environmental justice. It was a recognition that the environmental justice policy in the state was not doing enough and more needed to be done. So a couple of things that this executive order will do is it will target a greater enforcement activity in these overburdened communities, and it will begin to prioritize environmental cleanup and restoration, establishment of parks and environmental amenities and so forth in the most impacted communities. So very few states have this, and so I think the seriousness of the situation has been such that there has been a mobilization in the state to really say we need to do something about it because it is getting worse.
That's Dr. Daniel Faber, director of the Northeastern Environmental Justice Research Collaborative. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Faber, director of the Northeastern Environmental Justice Research Collaborative. Daniel Faber, if such injustice is falling on these communities, clearly, communities of color are able to organize and protest. We've seen that in recent weeks around the country. Why aren't more communities up in arms about the environmental threats they face?
Well, in some communities, there's been a long history of mobilization. If I go back to a community like Lawrence, one of the reasons it was so attractive is because it's a high immigrant community. So there are many different peoples coming in from different parts of the world. They speak different languages. They have different cultural backgrounds. And it's been very difficult for them to come together and mobilize and speak with one voice and to establish the solidarity that's necessary to resist the targeting of their community. In other communities like, for example, Roxbury, where there's much more of a homogeneous culture, then there's been a high degree of mobilization. So we've seen the environmental justice movement nationally grow up over the last 20 or 30 years, and I think one of the reasons for that is that this process by which ecological crises are being displaced onto less powerful communities, both domestically and internationally, is still a relatively new phenomenon. The movement is still in its infancy and is still growing, but is growing very, very rapidly, and we're really starting to see for the first time a joining, if you will, of mainstream environmental organizations and many environmental justice organizations around a common agenda. In the past, some of these different wings of the movement have been at odds with one another, competing for resources or whatever. But I think the environmental justice movement, at least in this state and in many other parts of the country, is gaining momentum.
During the recent weeks with all of the protests, the Black Lives Matter campaign, we have seen a number of traditional environmental groups step up and make statements of support, shows of solidarity. Sierra Club, NRDC, among others, used their blogs or their social media to kind of put this message out there that you know, we stand with you. Did that surprise you in any way? Is that what you're talking about, this melding of environmental justice and traditional environmentalism?
No, and it would have surprised me more 10 years ago. But we can add Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth to that list, as well as the Pesticide Action Network. There have been many mainstream environmental organizations that have really stepped up and have made the connections between racial injustice and ecological crises. And, you know, one of the slogans of the Black Lives Matter movement is that this notion, I can't breathe. And I can't breathe has a double meaning. It's not only about the increased repression that is being experienced in communities of color, but it's also about the deepening ecological crisis that literally, because of the concentration of polluting facilities, that people can't breathe. They breathe, Black and Latino and Asian Americans breathe different air than white Americans. So it's symbolic of a larger state of environmental injustice that is experienced in these communities. And I think there's a growing recognition that these different components of the movement have to come together and begin to forge a larger common agenda. The mainstream environmental movement has not won any major policy gain in the last 20 or 30 years. In many ways, climate change is too big for the environmental movement. So we're at a state where there's this tremendous business backlash that's being launched against the environmental movement, a tremendous counteroffensive, particularly by the most highly polluting corporations in the United States that have a big financial interest in rolling back environmental protection, what I call the polluter industrial complex. And so in many ways, the movement is on the defensive, and it needs to form a broader constituency and broader alliances if these gains are supposed to be made. And I'm actually quite encouraged. For example, just around climate change and the mobilization that's taken around that issue and the Keystone XL pipeline. You had 20,000 people a few months ago surround the White House and demanding that the Keystone XL pipeline not pass. And you have these really strange new political alliances developing, say, between indigenous peoples and Nebraska ranchers who would be impacted by the pipeline, as well as college students. And I think anytime you can bring together cowboys and Indians, you're creating something new in American politics. And likewise, in the climate justice march in New York, you had 400,000 people demonstrate their concern about the government in action, this tremendous threat that we're facing, yet the government is really not doing anything of significance to arrest it. So I think there's a recognition that traditional strategies that have been used by the mainstream environmental movement are proving to be increasingly ineffective, and that they need to reach out to the grassroots and mobilize people, enlarge their constituency by bringing in people of color and working class whites, and build a larger agenda that incorporates issues of economic and social justice into a platform for environmental justice.
You have a lot of community connections. I know when these traditional large environmental groups try to engage a community, try to come in and perhaps say, right, Black Lives Matter, I can't breathe, these are very much compatible with what we want to do. You know, we'd like to be a part of your community and helping you with your problems. What's the response on the community's part? Is it great, you're finally noticing, or is it a little bit of resentment of where have you been, and is this genuine, and do your goals really match up with ours?
Well, in the past, it was really more of a deep concern and in some cases resentment, because many in these communities, you had grassroots organizations that were doing work trying to fight polluting power plants that might be contributing to asthma or whatever. And so environmental justice began to appear in the national discourse. And the mainstream organizations then reached out to foundations and received a lot of money to do EJ work. But then they would come into working class communities or communities of color and attempt to impose their agenda. And they were receiving the foundation resources, but the groups that had been doing this work for many years were being ignored by the foundations. In fact, the environmental justice movement receives less than 0.1% of all foundation grants given in the United States. It's one of the most underfunded social movements in the country. And so that bred resentment. And I think over time, the mainstream environmental movement has learned its lesson and now tries to play much more of a support role in those communities where EJ organizations are already established, or will work much more collaboratively. And that's what we saw, for example, around Keystone XL Pipeline, of these movements that segments of the movements that in the past would have been at odds, now working together in a very cooperative fashion. So that's very encouraging, and that's so important to the evolution of a much more powerful, transformative environmental politics that can take on this tremendous power of corporate America to roll back environmental protection.
I wonder, especially when you mention climate justice, the Vatican actually has a stance on climate action, that this is a moral imperative, part of Christian values, to care for the poor and those less fortunate and with less power. That message seems very compatible with the environmental justice message that you're talking about. What is the relationship between the environmental justice movement and the religious community, not just Catholic, but more broadly the religious community?
Well, in many ways, so much of the civil rights movement grew out of the religious community, including Reverend Martin Luther King himself. So there's this long legacy within environmental justice movement of religious institutions and the church. United Church of Christ, for example, did one of the first environmental justice studies nationally, of being a bedrock. And in many communities, the church has been leading the way, even in communities in Massachusetts, for example, like Reverend Diaz in Freetown played a very fundamental role. The church was out in front of mobilizing that community to resist the imposition of some pretty hazardous facilities going into that community. So the church has long been involved, and many different denominations have been involved in environmental justice struggle. So what we're seeing now with the Catholic Church, I think, is very significant change and improvement, because the greatest impacts of climate change right now are being felt by the poorest, most oppressed segments of the world. In fact, climate change now is estimated to kill, Congressional Black Caucus says about 150,000, the United Nations says about 300,000 people a year are being killed by climate change. British government estimates that by 2050, as many as 200 million people can end up being displaced by climate change from rising sea levels alone. And we're now seeing a much more accelerated breakup of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Many glaciologists now believe that its demise is inevitable, and that would, of course, raise sea levels by 20 feet. So we are now – climate change is something that's going to happen in the future. 2014 was the hottest year on record. We are now entering a new climactic period, the Anthropocene. We are exiting the Holocene, the only climactic period in which human civilization has been present, and entering a whole new world. And the impacts already are being felt by those that are most vulnerable, by those that have the least resources and political power to weather the tremendous changes that are being brought about by climate change. So I don't think it's any accident then that, again, if you're really concerned about economic justice, which the new Pope obviously is, then you have to look at issues like climate change and the ecological crisis. We now have more climate environmental refugees in the world than we do war refugees for the first time in history. The disruption that is occurring to societies all around the world from climate change is, in many ways, we're just beginning, but it's accelerating, and it's already profound and will become more profound in the coming years.
Political surveys, public opinion surveys, have pretty consistently shown, both here in Massachusetts and on a national level, that Black and Hispanic populations, voters, are more concerned about climate change, more in favor of environmental action on the government level than voters at large, and certainly than their white counterparts. That's often explained as, you know, these are immigrant populations with ties back to some of these third world countries and more global connections that bring climate change and the realities of climate change home to them in some way. Do you think there's an explanation that sits more closer to home, that is simply that they're seeing the impacts of environmental pollution in their communities more strongly than other sectors of the American population, and that is causing their concern?
Yes, no, I think that's exactly right. I think that in many communities of color and lower income communities, the environmental crisis is a life and death issue. Leading cause of hospitalization for children in Massachusetts is for asthma attacks. And that stems largely from the concentration of pollution in those communities. 80% of Black Americans support President Obama's initiatives for taking significant steps on climate change. And that's compared to 76% for Hispanics and 60% for whites. The Congressional Black Caucus typically has the best voting record of any caucus around environmental issues. So many of this, you know, if you in the past, you look at surveys that went into some of the poorest communities in the United States or around the world, in the past they used to ask these false dichotomy questions where what's more important, feeding your family or protecting the environment? Well, for many people, protecting the environment was an absolutely necessary component of feeding their family because they derived their living directly from the land. And if the land became unsustainable, could no longer produce, then they could no longer feed their family. So for them, it was a false dichotomy. So poor people whose livelihoods are directly dependent upon the integrity of nature have some of the strongest environmental values that we find anywhere in the world. Typically, the poorer you are, the more the environment matters, particularly if it's a source of livelihood. So all around the world, you do see this environmentalism of the poor coming up from the bottom, from the grassroots.
We have just about a minute left to talk, and I want to ask you, there's a catch-22 here, that if you improve the environment in a particular community, it becomes more attractive to others, and the people who originally lived there can actually become displaced, priced out of their own community. How do we get around that? Is this really just an issue of needing to address poverty?
No, and that's becoming a really significant issue that you're seeing this in communities in Massachusetts, all across the eastern United States, San Francisco, that residents have spent their entire lives struggling to clean up their communities and make them more livable and more pleasant, find themselves confronted one day with much higher property taxes, rents, and housing values because of the improvements that they have won in their communities. And they're priced out, and they end up being displaced economically. So this process of environmental gentrification is a contradiction which the environmental justice movement in many communities have yet to resolve. It requires a very comprehensive approach. How can people come together and improve their communities and yet not be displaced economically? Because very often when they are, they end up going back into other communities that are more affordable but also more polluted. So how can we keep rents in control? The most important is to build affordable housing and to launch urban sustainability initiatives which really serve the needs of the residents in those communities and don't promote gentrification.
That's Dr. Daniel Faber. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Faber, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cowboys and Indians working together to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. That's quite a partnership. Here's another, kids and technology. The Eastern Coachella Valley, just 14 miles from Palm Springs, is a predominantly poor Latino community, home to a host of environmental concerns, ranging from arsenic in well water to toxic dump sites. Increasingly, though, young people are joining community activists working toward environmental justice, and they're doing it through crowdsourcing and other technology. Lisa Morehouse has this story.
Oh, the sewage drain that has yellow stuff on it.
Okay.
It's not every day that high school students choose to drive around with a college professor taking pictures of sewage failure.
Exploring.
But that's what Uriel Gutierrez and three of his friends are doing.
There's another puddle right there, but maybe it's just water.
We're looking for areas where there could be a potential problem with black water. Contaminated water that could carry diseases and bacteria.
Professor Ryan Sinclair of Loma Linda University explains. If a cesspool or septic system overflows, it can contaminate soil with bacteria and pathogens. That's dangerous, he tells them, especially for little kids playing outside.
You want to be separated from your human waste. I think we've been trying to do that for the last 6,000 years or so. So if you see it just out here, just wet dirt from a septic tank that's not working, it's just a bad case of environmental management and needs to be fixed.
Sinclair's the expert in water and sanitation, but the young men have the most knowledge about this community. Mobile home parks are prevalent here. Many are unpaved, miles from a main sewer line, and have overworked septic systems. The group stops at a mobile home park, which manages its wastewater with an aerated lagoon.
Yeah, I got the app.
Oh, okay, good. So you want to take a picture of it?
Mario yeah. Beltran's pretty comfortable using his smartphone for documentation.
I'm trying to take a picture about this waste lagoon water that we just found out right now.
The lagoon is too close to where people live, so he takes a picture.
And I'm going to update it on the app,
which will locate this spot on a map using its GPS coordinates. Professor Sinclair is training these high schoolers in crowdsourcing the data, having a large group of people collect needed information.
It looks gooey.
The group empties out of the truck at the edge of a mobile home park, and Gutierrez photographs a puddle.
It looks like corroded on the side, like you know how metal gets rusted? And in the middle, it looks like a nasty cheese and bean put together. Not edible, though.
He's starting to talk like a microbiologist.
What is that yellow?
Sinclair and a group of grad students held 5 weeks of training on crowdsourcing and sanitation. These teenagers said, at first, they came just to have something to do after school. Gutierrez was intrigued by the technology.
It was the whole app thingy that, you know, that brought me in. But now that, like, I kind of know how to use it, I'm more interested in the topic now.
And this spring, the guys went to Los Angeles to present their findings with the region's municipal water board. But they aren't the only teens getting involved. Belen Ramirez says she's passionate about the environment.
We're living here. We should take some interest in it.
She belongs to a club where students make videos and podcasts about issues important to them. For many, it's the environment. It's personal here, she says, in part because so many parents work in the fields and are worried about pesticides. Ramirez is working on a podcast with a message to public agency officials who've been coming here recently, talking about the region's environmental hazards.
You don't need to tell someone that their leg is broken if they see the bone jutting out. We know that we live here. So what I want to ask is, why don't they come and show us how to work with those agencies so that together we can come up with solutions to these problems?
She'll upload the podcast on the club's site and share it. Fellow club member Diana Castellanos produced a video about air quality, toxic dumping, and water access, which she presented at an environmental justice conference in February.
Some people from like Palm Springs that were there, they just like gasped. It's kind of interesting how they didn't know, and they live right here. It's like their backyard. There was just a whole bunch of gasps and we want to help, and all these people that were just amazed by the video that I made.
UC Davis professor Jonathan London was at the conference. He's leading a group of academics and local activists in a study of environmental justice in the region. And he was scheduled to present right after Castellanos and her peers shared the video.
And I joked in my little intro that I really didn't even have to provide my study because the young people had really nailed it. They had really talked about both environmental hazards and these social factors that make those environmental hazards worse.
He says his group study provided the hard data that essentially backed up the students' video.
Using the academic legitimacy that speaks to public agencies, but really they were by far the most legitimate spokespeople there because they had the most to lose.
Diana Castellanos already has her next video planned. And Belen Ramirez hopes to major in wildlife conservation when she heads to college in the fall.
Up next, labor economist Dr. Richard Freeman on how diversity benefits science. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Whether it's the environmental movement, as we just heard, or the tech sector, even academic science, there's mounting evidence that diversity is not only desirable on a social or ethical level, it actually quantifiably improves results. Dr. Richard Freeman is a labor economist with many titles. He holds the Herbert Asherman Chair in Economics at Harvard University, is a senior research fellow at the London School of Economics, and directs the National Bureau of Economic Research Sloan Science Engineering Workforce Projects and the Harvard Center for Green Buildings and Cities. He recently co-authored a study showing that scientific studies with more diverse author lists have more impact on their field of study. Dr. Freeman, welcome to Living Lab.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Why look at academic science specifically? Why single that sector out for looking at the impact of diversity?
Because we can measure the outcomes. Many team activities that people work together on, it's very hard to get the outcomes well measured. A scientific paper is a very measurable thing, and then the response to the paper is measurable. The only place where we have similar good measures of productivity is usually sports teams, where they win or lose, and you can look at who was on the team.
And do you know, have we looked at sports teams? Does diversity impact the success of sports teams?
I'm afraid I'm not enough of a sports fan to know. Someone may have done it, but I'm interested in the science community.
Since I couldn't tell a colleague who the New England Patriots had beat last week to get into the playoffs, I'm afraid I'm right there with you. So tell me about this study that you conducted late last year. It was published late last year. How did you actually, you say, you know, you have this information about scientific studies, who authored them, what impact they had. So explain a little bit of what you actually did to try to address this question.
Okay, well, what we noticed in the who writes scientific papers in the United States, that there were an increasing number of names of people that were not normal American names. So you'll notice in names that are Indian, from India, you'll notice a lot of names from China, Korea, and so on. And there are more Russian names than you might have expected from the country. And so what's happened, of course, is we've had a lot of immigrants coming into our country who get their PhDs in the country, stay in the country, and do scientific work. Now, how do we determine that the person is from a foreign country? Basically, we use the names, and what you'll quickly see, a name like Zhu Wang is not going to be an American name. That's a name of someone from China, and there's some modest errors because there may be someone who's Zhu Zhang and was born in America, but unlikely. American Chinese would be David Wang or something like that. And so we first just looked and said, how many of these people are there? How many different ethnic groups? So we have a category for English names, Russian names, Indian names, Chinese names. And then you'll notice if you look at scientific papers, you often see the names of people are often of the same nationality on a paper. They'll often be mixed as well. So we wondered whether or not the people who worked with people only of their own national origin, as reflected in their names, were better or worse or different in any way from the papers that were produced by people of more diverse ethnicity.
And the result was that the more diverse ones were actually more important studies.
That's right. More diverse ones they get into better journals, and they get cited more often, and so the interpretation is they're better papers.
To play devil's advocate for just a moment, going solely on names, especially given the premise that you started with, that we've had more immigrants into this country, this is the melting pot. An African-American man could be named Joe Smith, so could a white man. We could have someone with a Chinese name who's actually a third generation Chinese American. How confident are you that a name alone can represent someone's ethnicity or race?
Well, on race, the Joe Smith one is perfect that you picked. We have no way of determining, or we made no effort to determine a race of people. So that's not The name does not tell you much about that. The ethnicity is there's a computer program written by a colleague at the Harvard Business School that uses Social Security records and actually gives you the probability that a person with a given name is of a given ethnicity. So that basically gives us a probability, and we use that probability. So someone whose name is, I gave the name Zhu Wang, that person is probably 99.9% Chinese. And what we did to differentiate the third generation person, or Chinese, is the American Chinese just don't use that name. And you can also go to these records and sort of establish that. And you can think of the Chinese friends, American-born friends. Their names are very different. The first names are basically anglicized names. You also can do this by looking at the names before the big immigration push. In the case of China, the immigrants came into our country in science, doing science, largely in the last 20-odd years. So you can go back and you can look at the names before then as opposed to the names afterwards.
So I find it interesting, often when we think about, say, diversity in science, it's about, on the grand scale, trying to get more people of color, more people from diverse international backgrounds into the field, not necessarily worrying about which lab they end up working in. But what you're saying is it's not enough to just have 20% Chinese and 20% African-American, 20% Russian and 20% American in our scientific workforce as a whole, but that we need to be mixing it up and making sure that all of those different ethnicities are working together. Do you think that a study like yours could perhaps, you know, if you're going carrot versus stick, could be an enticement to get scientists to seek out people of different backgrounds and origins to collaborate with?
I would hope so, but the ethnicities are, what you really want is diversity of ideas. The ethnicities are not the diversity of ideas. They're connected, and we think that's the ultimate cause. Is if I'm working, I'm a Chinese fellow, and I'm working in a lab with only Chinese co-workers, and the senior professors are Chinese, there'll be some set of ideas that we work on, which will be different in some ways than a lab, let's say, headed by someone from France, where there's a different scientific culture or different questions may be asked, and so on. So I actually view the ethnicity much more as an indicator of the diversity of ideas. And it probably, had we measured, which we didn't do, everybody coming from the same lab, we would find something very similar to what we found when people are working with people only of their ethnicity. Indeed, there is a tremendous tendency. If you're a professor, let's say if you're from Turkey, that your lab will be extraordinarily loaded up with people of Turkish descent. You know people from your home country, they know who you are, and that in our analysis, that does not produce the best science. It's better to have people more scattered among different labs.
The way that science works, though, is that you've got, you know, one lab or one group puts forward an idea, and then another group should be testing that and building on it. Could it be enough to have each of those different ideas, you know, the Turkish paper and the Chinese paper come out, and then the Russian group comes in and says, well, we have a slightly different take on these two papers and we're going to advance it. And perhaps each individual paper, each individual study doesn't seem as innovative, but we could get to the same end result eventually by having that mixing, that melding of ideas going on perhaps at a slightly higher level.
Oh, that's a great thought, and that's definitely a possibility. What I would expect in that case, though, is it takes longer for the ideas to develop. or to get the better, the best ideas or the best interpretation of the evidence to come out than if it happened earlier in the process. So, you know, by the time things go through journals and this one criticizes and that one criticizes, and that clearly is a good process. But it would be better to have the debates or things inside your own lab and get it resolved so the paper comes out and it's initially better. But you have a very correct point.
Have you personally experienced or witnessed the benefits of having a more diverse group in your own research, in your own career?
Oh, yes. I've worked with several different groups on different topics. This is social science as opposed to physical science, of course. And now I'm working with a lot of Chinese people, and the Chinese researchers bring a certain perspective from China. They have knowledge of some data. They have some knowledge of people's behavior that I or my American students can't have that same insights. But we bring something else. We bring a critical, a different look at the Chinese experience. In social science, I think it's even probably more, possibly at least, more important than in the physical sciences. Because in social science, everybody brings something from their own experience and national background. And so the French do see things differently than the Americans. So if you have the two groups, two working together, you're likely to get different insights than if we had the process where the French write their papers, the Americans write their papers. They may criticize each other, but it's harder, I think, to get an innovative idea coming out that would illuminate from both sides' perspectives.
I mean, to your point that it could be even more important to have diversity in social science, that seems really logical because, of course, the laws of physics are the same all over the planet. It doesn't matter where you came from. They're all still the same laws of physics. And yet your research shows that it doesn't matter if the facts are the same, that cultural diversity is still important in pushing new ideas forward in science.
That's absolutely correct.
How do you, in your day-to-day going about your job, how do you seek out diversity, racial, cultural, ethnic, or just as you called it, the diversity of ideas? How do you consciously seek that out?
Well, I probably don't consciously seek it out in the sense of I feel a lot. Students come and they have ideas, and then we put together groups to work on different projects. I mean, some of this comes from not the senior scientist, but from the younger scientists or the younger, the postdocs or the graduate students who because it's not a game where the senior person picks people. I mean, the people have to come and connect and so on. What I suppose I do, this is I go to a lot of conferences and meetings, and I'm always looking for somebody different who has a different perspective or a different view. And when I go to listen to sessions of papers by people outside my own specialty, that's where I often get, oh, that's a neat thing. I never thought of that. And more often than not, that is somebody who has a different training and background than I have. So you get insights from going to these meetings, and that's where you can pick up and connect with new people.
Look for someone different. The advice from Dr. Richard Freeman, labor economist and the co-author of a recent study showing that scientific papers with more diverse author lists have more impact on their field of study. Dr. Richard Freeman, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.